Extra value meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hitting a guy in a Kevlar vest who later thinks it's funny with a sandwich that stays in its wrapper and does not, contrary to testimony, explode.
Right.
And cause, say, damage to that beautiful white shirt you're wearing, Sam. You know, that I think a jury could reasonably conclude that that's not offensive to a person of reasonable sensitivity.
Hey, everybody. It's me, Sam Stein, managing editor at The Bork. And this is George Conway Explains It All to Sarah Longwell, who I am not. George is a renowned scholar of many things, but for the purpose of this podcast, he is our legal explainer. And for the purpose of this specific podcast, he is channeling the ghost of Bob Marley. Is that correct, George?
Yes.
Okay. People will get the joke if they just Google it or just follow George's Twitter feed.
Happy sandwich, but I did not throw no condiments.
The joke is in reference to what we're going to talk about today to start off with. Which is the sandwich man, DC's hero, who threw a hoagie at a Border Patrol agent in our city. Wow. Already. I want people to know this is 10:35 a.m. and George is just biting into a Subway footlong. The sandwich man is free. The jury ruled yesterday that he was acquitted. It is a huge embarrassment for Jeanine Pirro and the administration. But George, I got to be honest with you, and this is where I want you to start explaining things for me. Why is he free? I mean, there's video, very evident video of him taking the hoagie, tossing it hard into this man's chest. That's not in dispute. And I thought you're not allowed to throw sandwiches at cops, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that.
Okay.
The statute, I think it's 18 U.S.C. 111, talks about forcible assault. And forcible assault and impeding officers and so on and so forth. But let's just focus on the word forcibly assaulting an officer. The question, there's no question that, and this is the way the judge looked at it. I think the defense may have looked at it a little bit differently, but the judge said, okay, there's no issue. There was force involved, physical force in the sense that there was the impulsion of the sandwich toward the vest of the officer.
Back into the left, right into the officer.
Back into the left. You know, Yoshinobu, Yamamoto with his javelin, woof, right.
Yeah.
So, so the Cy Young Award winning protester.
Dodgers pitcher. Anyway.
So, what's assault? And there was a dispute over, the way jury trials work is the judge delivers instructions about what the law says to the jury and tries to do that in as plain English as possible. And then it is the job of the jury to look at those instructions using their understanding of the English language as laid down in the judge's instructions and to apply it to the facts that they saw from the stand and to make, based upon the admissible evidence, a reasoned judgment as to what happened and whether it, how it fits into the instructions. And so the question became, well, what is assault under Section 111 of this statute, this law? And the way the judge defined it was, assault is any attempt or threat to inflict injury or that places another in immediate apprehension of bodily harm. So the question is then, you know, you just sort of, this often happens within the law and in jury instructions, is that, okay, they define one word, but you have to define one word in terms of other words. And then you get to the question of, well, what the hell do these other words mean? And the jury actually came back with a question during its deliberations, which is, hey, judge, what's the difference between injury in that first clause that you gave us and bodily harm in the second? And the defense had some argument, oh, well, that's a little different. But the judge ultimately said, it's the same thing. And so the question became, what's injury and what's bodily harm? And it's the same thing. And the definition that the judge gave of injury was any physical injury, including touching offensive to a person of reasonable sensitivities. So, you know, you could go, you know, this is the thing about jury instructions and laws, you go on forever. Well, what does that mean? But the bottom line is, not any touching amounts to injury, and it's not any touching amounts to an attempt to inflict injury, even a forcible touching with the sandwich. And so the question is, what's touching offensive to a person of reasonable sensitivities? Is this offensive to you?
Yes.
Well, yes, if I got it on that white shirt of yours. But what if you were wearing, what if you were wearing a bulletproof Kevlar vest?
Yeah.
That protects you from munitions.
Okay. Oh my God. Well, the guy said he got mustard and onions on his vest.
He lied.
Because the sandwich was still intact.
He said this was a very important factual question at trial. And the defense argued that the police officer was just puking out false information.
Okay.
Basically, he said the sandwich exploded on my chest. And the defense said, there's the sandwich on the ground. It didn't explode. It's just laying there on the ground.
It was still in the wrapper.
And this is the trial that we had, you know. So what happened to the sandwich? Did the sandwich explode? Was the hitting of the sandwich to the vest on unreasonable touching that a person of reasonable sensitivities would deem offensive? And the jury said, we're not buying it. We can't swallow this. You've given us a lot to chew on.
Oh,
and
God.
We're just spitting out these charges. And they delivered, you know, as fast as an Uber Eats driver, they delivered a verdict of acquittal. And that's basically the case.
George has been clearly workshopping his sandwich puns in anticipation of this podcast. He fit in about
And to borrow something somebody
right
said, the po' boy was set free.
Oh, my God. That's the worst of the bunch. I want to actually step
back
for a second.
Are you going to condiment my pun serving ability?
Are we going to edit these out? Because these are so bad. I want to make point that how bad this prosecution went for Jeanine Pirro. So Jeanine Pirro is U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia.
Where's my
they
wine?
They really wanted to make... Yeah, it's just 10:30, George. She wanted to make an example of this guy, Sean Dunn, really badly. Now, the first thing they did was they sent like a dozen dudes in like gear, riot gear, into this guy's apartment in the West End, not so far from our office here. They knocked on his door. They had the sizzle reel of him being arrested. It was ridiculous, right? It was totally ridiculous. Pirro cut a video in which she's sitting there all smug, arms crossed, saying, stick your Subway sandwich somewhere else.
Stick your Subway sandwich somewhere else.
And then they didn't get a felony assault charge. That was the first thing that they tried to do. So then they came back with this charge and they got an acquittal again. If you were like in the DC, the attorney's office for the District of Columbia, I mean, on the levels of humiliation, one being, I can live with this. It's fine. I'm totally content. 10 being like, I need to like, you know, brush this off my resume. I'm so humiliated by this. Where would you stand?
Look, I mean, as far as the line trial lawyers are concerned, sometimes you're just forced to try cases that you don't believe in.
Sure.
I mean, it's a little less so with the Justice Department. But it wasn't a case that was absurd, sort of technically, to try.
No. In fact, I thought it was a fine case to try. Right, I just shocked that they didn't get a conviction.
Well, they didn't get a conviction because it was, you know, sometimes it's just stupid, right? It's just stupid. I mean, here's what common sense would have said should happen in this case. The guy threw the sandwich at the cop, right? Mm-hmm. And the cops actually thought it was funny. I mean, one of the things that happened at trial was that the defense, in order to show that this was not a touching that was so horrible, they put into evidence the fact that the cop got joke gag gifts from his fellow cops, and that they were all making fun of the fact that he was the guy who was assaulted on his Kevlar vest.
To be clear, they gave him a plush sandwich and a patch featuring a cartoon of Dunn, the perpetrator, throwing the sandwich with the words "felony footlong." That's what he got from his colleagues.
I thank you for that reporting. It's just important to get the facts in, and that's why. Absolutely. And so, you know, this is what should have happened here is this. In a normal situation, not 2025 in Trump's America, is the guy would have been arrested, right? It wouldn't have been on camera, but he would have gotten arrested and he would have been hauled in. He would have spent the night in jail. And he was drunk. I mean, if you saw the video, the guy was drunk as shit. And it would be just like, you know, Otis, probably this is too dated for this all audiences, but remember the Andy Griffith Show, and they used to have the drunk in Mayberry, and his name was Otis, and they'd just throw him in the clink overnight until he sobered up, and then they let him go. That's what should have happened here, right? You get 24 hours in the United States of America to arraign somebody on a crime after they've been arrested on the street for, you know, what the officer sees as probable cause. And this guy should have been let go the next day. Maybe he's arraigned and he puts up $100 bail, or he's released on recognizance because this guy was like he was a paralegal at the DOJ. He's not going anywhere, although he got fired. And then the prosecutors would say, what are we going to do with this? Okay, he spent the night in jail. That's it. We're going to drop the charges. That's what should have happened here. And instead, the reason why it became such a big embarrassment and the reason why it's absurd when the MAGA people, when I did my Bob Marley impression yesterday, were attacking me for, I am not showing proper respect for the police officers. It's like, I don't think you should throw sandwiches at cops. But I also don't think you should go to prison or be convicted of a crime for throwing a sandwich at a cop when the cop thinks it's funny. And the only thing that happens is there's a little oil on the Kevlar vest. Okay. The guy was drunk. Take him in, arrest him, bust him, book him, and then let him go. All right. That's not technically, the legal thing to do, but it's the just thing to do. It is the practical thing to do. It does rough justice. And, they do have probable cause to arrest him and put him in the clink for a night.
Sure.
So that's what should have happened. And jurors understand that. And then because when you actually take the case to court, you can fit this into the boxes of a crime as you felt. And that's the reason why you thought, well, it wasn't assault. But it's incongruous. It's just like, why are we doing it? It's just a sandwich. The guy wasn't hurt. It was funny. It's ridiculous. And the administration, foolishly, Pirro and the White House, I think the White House even put out a video.
White House put out the video.
It was the White House. It's like, why are you raising the stakes on this one thing? Okay. Right. Okay. The guy shouldn't have done it, but you're essentially poking fun at yourself. These people, and it really highlights the absurdity. This is the stupidity of the Trumpers. It's like they're talking about cities burning and people dying. Where are these people? All they got is sandwich guy, basically. And I think the jury was well within its purview in making the determination that hitting a guy in a Kevlar vest who later thinks it's funny with a sandwich that stays in its wrapper and does not, contrary to testimony, explode and cause, say, damage to that beautiful white shirt you're wearing, Sam. I think a jury could reasonably conclude that That's not offensive to a person of reasonable sensitivities, as per the judge's instruction.
This show is sponsored by Laundry Sauce. There's something about this season. The crisp air, the cozy layers, the unmistakable holiday scent. Laundry Sauce lets you capture that in every wash. From fireside comfort to crisp sophistication, each scent is designed to set the tone for your day and now for the holidays. Himalayan Cashmere is their newest launch and their first ever hypoallergenic fragrance created to be gentle on even the most sensitive skin, which I have sensitive skin. A soft blend of airy florals, sweet pear, and warm amber wraps you in instant comfort, while a base of creamy sandalwood and Himalayan musk lingers like your favorite cashmere blanket. It's sophisticated yet inviting, cozy yet elevated, like a quiet mountain retreat in the middle of the holidays. And that sounds nice. Whichever vibe you want to set, the Signature and Essentials package deliver the full experience. Detergent pods, scent boosters, dryer sheets, and more. All designed to infuse your laundry with high-end fragrance, fight stains, and elevate your laundry to five-star status. And here's the best part. Laundry Sauce is having their biggest sale of the year. Get up to 40% off site-wide for a limited time, so you can stock up, gift boldly, or simply treat yourself to laundry luxury that shows up right at your door. No last-minute store runs, no heavy bottles to lug, just everything you need exactly where you need it. And let me tell you, I endorse a lot of products across my shows, and this is one of those products that the people in my shop who work here really get lost in the sauce for, as it were. The producer who wrote this ad wishes it to be known that the Siberian pine pods are exceptional. This holiday season, turn your routine into a ritual with Laundry Sauce. During our Black Friday, Cyber Monday signature sale, you'll save up to 40% off, get $75 in free gifts, and free shipping at laundrysauce.com. It's the perfect time to treat yourself or gift the world's most luxurious detergent to someone you love. Thanks, Laundry Sauce.
I will say you're absolutely right that this was, from a political perspective, kind of absurd, right? Like they people have to remember, they just made the case that DC was a crime-ridden hellhole where you couldn't even walk the streets to go get a reservation at a restaurant. And the first sizzle reel video they put out is of this like upscale West End apartment where this guy's just sitting by himself and they're busting down his door and taking him away as if like they've solved the crime epidemic somehow with this one arrest. So it was very silly. I do have to do an ad read here.
Yes.
George Conway explains it all, brought to you by Subway, where you can get... No, just kidding. We're not being sponsored by Subway on this one, although it would be appropriate. I do think Sean Dunn has a future if he ever wants it in specialty novelty sandwiches in the district. It could be a big moneymaker for him. But we'll see where he goes from here. He is a lawyer. Maybe he gets swooped up by one of the many, many law firms in this city. I want to switch, though, and I have an
Actually, I think he's only a paralegal.
A paralegal. Okay.
I do agree with you. Excuse me, ma'am.
Yeah.
I'm chewing on my sandwich. Very big sandwich. I ordered double meat last night to celebrate.
Is it salami? Because his sandwich was salami.
He was positioned pepperoni, but this is the salami right there. See
all
it?
All right.
See, that's mustard and mayo.
Oh, my God. This is the worst.
Oh, my God. this is offensive. No, but I do agree with you. This guy has a future.
He does.
You know, I mean, somebody posted online that if there, what are we even doing in this world if a sandwich shop does not come up with a special new sandwich called the acquittal? And I think this guy, if I were Jersey Mike's, I would get rid of Danny DeVito and I would get,
put
sandwich guy, Sean Dunn in there and say, here's my special new sandwich, the acquittal. Come get your verdict now at a Jersey Mike's near you. And Subway should just jump right at him. I mean, this guy was acquitted as opposed to Jared.
Yeah, I was going to say, hopefully Sean Dunn has a better run as a sandwich spokesperson than Jared. I want to make a shift to James Comey. Here's how I'm going to do the segue, which is we have a couple instances now where Trump officials are really, you know, striking out in court or at least tripping over themselves. And this week, we saw that in this James Comey trial where the federal judge really admonished the prosecution, saying that they're indicting first, presenting evidence later. This whole thing seems pretty doomed to me, and I think to a lot of people, starting with Lindsey Halligan's installment at the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Eastern District of Virginia, the haphazard way that she put together these indictments. What is your take about how this has started off?
This case is going to go away, and there are about six ways to Sunday that it's going to go away.
What's your prediction for how it goes away?
You know, there are so many different ways it can go down. I hesitate to pick any one way. It could go down on multiple bases. I mean, this comment made by the judge, yes, it was actually the magistrate judge and not the district judge is going to try the case, but that's going to be the reaction of any judge who sees this case. And, you know, I mean, there are a bunch of things going on, as we previously discussed. I mean, there is there's a judge in South Carolina who's taking this case on because none of the judges there can take it because they're actually technically involved in the appointment of U.S. attorneys at some point. And that's the question of whether Lindsey Halligan had any more authority than you or I or my corgis to indict, to go into a grand jury and present an indictment in the Eastern District of Virginia. And I think the answer is going to be no, she had no authority. And there was nobody else in the Justice Department that was in there with her or able to sign the indictment. Now, and the fact that the Justice Department realizes they have a big problem here because Pam Bondi last week did this bit where she says, I reviewed the grand jury materials, although not all of them are available, frankly. And I am retroactively appointing Lindsey Halligan pursuant to some other provision or appointing her a special attorney for the Justice Department. And that was her way of trying to solve the problem. But to me, that just only shows that they know that the appointment was invalid in the first place. So that's one way this can go down. Another way this can go down is there's something, you know, what happened in front of that grand jury? Because these charges, as we've talked about before, make no sense. In fact, when you really get down to the nitty-gritty about it, it's kind of hard to explain because what happened was that the testimony doesn't match up to the facts that they are trying to show that the testimony was false. Because what was clearly going on was that the questioning both times that Comey was before Congress, the first time that this is not subject to the charges with Grassley, and then when Cruz went over the testimony in 2000, which is the case that, which is what exactly, almost exactly 5 years before this indictment was brought, you know, that clearly the testimony that Comey was given was about whether or not he had his deputy, McCabe, leak something about the Hillary investigation.
Right.
It wasn't about this other fellow, his friend in New York, Daniel Richmond, who prior to 2017 had been used, I think, as kind of a press go-between by Comey, right, and was gone from the Justice Department by 2021, when this same fellow was, you know, handed some information to the press for Comey. But
Just to summarize,
yeah,
they're saying you perjured yourself when you said you didn't leak because you had leaked with Andy McCabe. But in fact, the indictment has nothing to do with any conversations with Andy McCabe. It has to do with conversations about Daniel Richmond. So it's totally unrelated to the accusation of perjury.
That's right. And what happened in the indictment is, and it's a problem you actually have in lots of perjury cases, which is that the questioning is ambiguous in some ways. What happened was there's a lot of specific questioning, both by Cruz and by Senator Grassley, that really clearly relates to the Clinton, and they specifically refer to the Clinton and the Trump investigations. And then there's specific references in the questioning to McCabe. But, you know, when you have senators asking questions, they talk a lot. And so they go, blah, 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 McCabe, Trump, Clinton, McCabe. Did you ever leak anything? And so what they've done is they've divorced the did you ever leak anything from the context of McCabe and Clinton and Trump. And that's how they get Richmond in. Even though what Richmond did at the FBI as a not permanent employee, he was answering questions about matters that had nothing to do with any of this shit years before. So anyway, so it's substantively bad. But the other problem is, how did Halligan get this grand jury to indict on those charges? Did she actually explain the evidence in a coherent fashion that made clear what was being charged? And she had never been before a grand jury. She really had barely practiced. And I mean, she was a lawyer, but it was not clear that she had a lot of litigation experience. She certainly didn't have any, as I mentioned before, a grand jury or in criminal prosecution. This transcript, everybody thinks is going to be fucked up in some significant way, that she screwed this up. And she screwed, and another more evidence that she screwed this up was the fact that she kept the grand jury going into this very, very simple case. She kept the grand jury going into 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And then she got confused about which piece of paper was supposed to go to the judge. There were charges that were rejected. The charges that were accepted by the grand jury and that went into the ultimate indictment, they were only approved by 13 out of the 24 grand jurors, which is sufficient. But it's kind of really bad when a prosecutor can't get the grand jurors to all to agree. And also, as right. I mentioned, some one of the charges. So we know that the transcript is going to be a mess, that she's probably going to look foolish. And it turns out that in the proceeding to disqualify her as not having been properly appointed, the government at first did not produce the entire grand jury transcript. They only produced the FBI agent's testimony, and they didn't produce all parts where Halligan was telling the grand jury what they wanted the grand jury to do and what the law was and explaining the indictment to.
So this could be like a fruits of a poisonous tree type situation.
Yeah. It could be just basically like the indictment doesn't match up to what the grand jurors heard. It could be completely improper.
So everything else that subsequently follows from there is irrelevant because you screwed up the original charge.
And to go back to the appointment issue, the appointment problem with the appointment issue isn't fixable, arguably, because she was the only person in there. And then, you know, like a couple of days later, the statute of limitations expired, a 5-year statute. He gave this testimony like at the end of, I think it was it September 2020? And at the end of September 2025, the indictment was 3 or 4 days old and the statute of limitations is running. If the indictment is invalid, you can't go back now. You can't extend the statute of limitations because you are an attorney general who's a dummy who appointed failed to appoint properly a U.S. attorney who is also a dummy. So, there are so many ways this prosecution should and probably will go down. The worst case would be it goes to trial and it gets laughed out of court by the jury.
Why is that the worst case?
I don't think it's a bad case. I think it's actually in some ways would be great to actually see the trial because it would be just a shit show for the government. But I don't think it's going to get that far. And at a minimum, I think the judge could easily just he could hold the trial, wait for the prosecution's evidence to come in, and then grant a verdict for the defense on the basis that no jury could reasonably find the defendant guilty. And that would be jeopardy. It would mean that there would be no appeal. And Comey would be free forevermore because any further effort to prosecute him under federal law for these crimes would be double jeopardy.
All right, that makes a lot of sense. I know we have a special guest to discuss the actual big legal issue of the week, which was the Supreme Court arguments around Trump's tariffs. Steve Vladeck, who is an expert on all things Supreme Court and way smarter than me on this stuff, he's going to join George to talk about that in a much more in-depth manner. But I don't think you're going to be eating Subway sandwiches with Steve, so I think you'll have less
Well,
fun.
He actually made the best joke about it. The po' boy joke was his in a text chain. Anyway.
Okay. Well, tell him I say hi. George, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. Everyone, stick around for George's second part of the podcast with Steve Vladeck, where they're going to talk about the tariff case and the possibility that Trump's signature economic policy could become crashing down sometime in the winter or maybe in the spring.
This show is sponsored by HexClad. Holiday season is here, and let's be real, the kitchen is where it all goes down. Big roasts, game day feasts, endless sides, and all those holiday desserts. And if your current pans panic at high heat or burn the gravy, it's time for an upgrade. Enter HexClad, the cookware that's as serious about performance as you are about carving that holiday turkey. These pans give you the perfect sear, crazy durability, and easy cleanup without the babysitting. I have quite enough babysitting in my life, and I love that with HexClad, I'm not babysitting pots and pans. They've got stainless steel strength, toxin-free, nonstick convenience, and yeah, they look damn good on the stovetop when the whole crew is over. Whether you're starting fresh or going big, these bundles cover every dish, every craving, every holiday spread. Plus, every HexClad product comes with a lifetime warranty, so you're not just buying cookware, you're setting someone up for years of meals, memories, and celebrations. Hexclad 6-piece set is the perfect starter bundle for any kitchen. It includes three of their most popular pans with matching lids, giving you everything you need to handle daily cooking with ease. From breakfast to dinner, these pans deliver pro-level performance, effortless cleanup, and durability that lasts a lifetime. This season, don't just shop for gifts. Give the upgrade every kitchen deserves. Take 10% off at hexclad.com/askgeorge and cook like a pro all holiday long. Treat yourself or give the gift of cookware that delivers for every meal, every gathering, every season. That's hexclad.com/askgeorge. Support the show and let them know we sent you.
And welcome back to George Conway Explains It All, except this part of George Conway Explains It All, I don't have to do any explaining at all, which is my favorite part, and that's great. And we have a guest, and we've only had like two guests in the history of this podcast, but this guest is, he's the most important guest you will ever have here, because he is the best legal explainer on the planet. He has a wonderful, his name is Steve Laddick. He is a professor of law at Georgetown, and he has this wonderful Substack called One First, which I advise, if you have become a legal addict to the travails of the Trump administration, you must immediately subscribe to this, because this is where, like, I save so much time just going to his blog on Substack. And not only that, he's a funny guy. I mean, it's not, you know, he doesn't make jokes in his blog, but yesterday on a group text, he had some commentary on the most important case, the one we just talked about, the sandwich guy case, where he said the po' boy is set free. And that is the single best line I thought of yesterday. Anyway, welcome, Steve. We're going to talk about the less important case of the one that affects the global economy and the future of humanity, the tariffs case. Nothing is nearly as important as a sandwich, but here we are. So we've talked about one of the tariff cases on this podcast previously, the one that went to the Court of International Trade and up to the Federal Circuit. And that was one of the cases that was argued this week up for the Supreme Court. And we talked about IEEPA and how it gives the power to the president, very roughly, of regulating imports in the case of an emergency. And you kind of think that's really like, oh yes, what if there's a war with such and so and you, whatever. And that doesn't really include the taxing for a emergency that really is an emergency because the country has had a trade deficit forever. So we've talked about that, but there's a second case here, as I understand it. And it was brought in the United States District Court, not the Court of International Trade, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, and then was appealed, the government lost, and then was appealed to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, which is different from the Federal Circuit. And then there's this process called certiorari before judgment, where before a Court of Appeals can decide something, the Supreme Court can take it if some party asks for it, and both parties basically ask for it. One party asks for it, the government, and then the other party acquiesce. Why are there two cases, and what difference does it make?
So there are two cases, George, because baked into this big fight over the president's substantive authority is a deliciously nerdy fight about which district court
has jurisdiction. Did you say delicious? Did you say delicious?
This is the problem, is that you're 3 hours ahead of me. It's not lunchtime yet here. So
it's not even lunchtime here.
Yeah, fair enough. It's lunchtime somewhere. The relevant statute here is a very obscure provision of the Court of International Trade's exclusive jurisdiction, which says that only the Court of International Trade can hear challenges to, and I'm going to quote here, a civil action that arises out of any law of the United States providing for tariffs. Well, the problem, of course, is that the challenger's arguments in these cases is that IEEPA does not provide for tariffs. And so the sort of the
that's a little head spinning.
Well, it is a little head spinning. Both the Court of International Trade and the Federal Circuit dealt with this question, I think, quite effectively. The Federal Circuit said, even if the tariffs don't arise out of IEEPA, they at least do arise out of the president's executive orders. And so they read the statute to encompass the sort of the correct jurisdictional predicate insofar as it was tied to the executive orders. George, this doesn't really matter that much, because the reason why the Supreme Court took that other case from the D.C. District Court was so that one way or the other, it can reach the merits. It really is either or. It just affects whether, you know, the ultimate decision of the court to affirm or reverse comes in the Federal Circuit case or in the D.C. District Court case. But it won't affect, right, what the underlying ruling is.
Was there any particular reason why the government wanted both cases up there?
So the government didn't. The petition for cert before judgment in the DDC case was from the plaintiffs after they won.
Okay.
Which is unusual, but not unheard of. And I think, you know, the sort of the court had initially denied the plaintiffs' request that they expedite consideration of their petition. But once the Federal Circuit had ruled and once it had blocked the tariffs, the other petition became this attractive way of ensuring that there was no jurisdictional problem, that no matter what, the justices could reach the merits one way.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Or the other.
Okay, so what the issue ultimately, again, is then the same as what was decided in the D.C. Circuit, but also there was a second issue on delegation. What's that about?
Yeah, so the petition that the federal government filed in the Federal Circuit case raises both the statutory question of whether the tariffs are authorized by IEEPA and the constitutional question of, if so, can Congress really write such an open-ended delegation to the president? Now, of course, the Trump administration thinks the answer to both questions is yes, but there are at least some justices, and I think Justice Gorsuch is probably the most visible example, who might be attracted to splitting the difference, who might be attracted to thinking, you know, even if IEEPA does authorize the tariffs, it couldn't, because Congress can't give the president such a blank check. And we heard Justice Gorsuch. I mean, during the oral argument on Wednesday, I thought, George, one of the most striking exchanges was when Justice Gorsuch was pressing Solicitor General Sauer on how hard it would be in practice for Congress to claim back any of the authority the Trump administration claims it has given, right? That you would need veto-proof supermajorities at both chambers. George, that smacks to me both as sort of a consequentialist argument from Justice Gorsuch, which is unusual, but also a bit of a non-delegation argument. We don't expect Congress to write a blank check, given how hard it is for Congress to then stop payment.
So Congress couldn't do this even if it wanted to, but it didn't do it in the first place. And so the government, you can go both ways with it.
Well, and indeed, I mean, perhaps that's also just another way of counting the five votes, which is, you know, you could have four or five justices who don't read IEEPA as authorizing the tariffs. And then you could have one or two who say either, yes, it does, or it doesn't matter if it does because it couldn't authorize the tariffs. And you'd end up in the same place, which is that the tariffs are unlawful. I don't know how likely that is, but that's the work that the non-delegation doctrine is doing in these cases.
So we're kind of backing into the ultimate question, which is who's going to win and how did the argument go and what's the vote count based upon the questioning, which is always a perilous exercise, although I think there are several justices who you know are going to come out a certain way or very likely. I always found one of the best indicia, and I don't know whether this happened because I didn't watch the argument or read the transcript because I was so consumed with the all-important sandwich case. But my guide to oral arguments is 9 times out of 10, the side that gets the most questions loses. I don't know. What was your impression of the argument?
Let me work backwards, which is, I think, is going to be annoying.
Okay.
I count five votes that I'm confident of. I am confident that all three of the Democratic appointees are solid votes against the Trump administration. And George, I'm confident that Justices Thomas and Alito are solid votes for the Trump administration. It's the other four, not surprisingly, that is the ballgame. And I'll just say there, I have sort of different margins of confidence. Of the other four, the one of whom I'm the most confident is Chief Justice Roberts. You know, he asked the very, very first question after Justice Thomas's usual first question of the Solicitor General, And it was not a friendly question. I mean, it was getting right to the heart of why they can't just, you know, decide this case very easily on the basis of the major questions doctrine.
Now, what's the major questions doctrine? What is that? I think our viewers want to know what that is. Has to do with mice, I think, right?
It started with mice. So this is a relatively recent innovation in the court's sort of statutory interpretation jurisprudence, the idea of which is that Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. Basically, that if Congress is giving the president the power to, you know, act on matters of what they call, what the court calls vast economic or political significance, that Congress is going to say so specifically. And so ambiguity, George, in that space is categorically resolved against the executive branch. That was the basis on which the court struck down a bunch of Biden administration policies, some COVID mitigation measures, most notably the student loan debt forgiveness program. And, you know, it seems like a natural fit here because whatever else might be said about IEEPA, the 1977 statute on which the administration is relying, doesn't say a word about tariffs. So the fact that Robert started there, George, and sort of how he kept going through the argument, I see as a sign that he is likely the fourth vote against the tariffs. The messy question is there a fifth? And, you know, I think Justice Barrett has become very, very hard to predict, even based on the questions she asks at the oral argument. She asked, I thought, tough questions of both sides. You know, I think Justice Kavanaugh also asked challenging questions of both sides. I also think he's never going to be the fifth vote against the Trump administration. He might be the sixth or the seventh.
And why do you say that?
Justice Kavanaugh is not a justice who's going to die on the hill of cutting off deference to the executive in a foreign affairs or national security case. He'll follow the crowd, I think, if the rest of the court's doing it. But he's not, if it comes down to him, that is not his instinct, which is why I actually think, you know, the most, to me, at least based on the argument, the most likely fifth vote, I think, is Justice Gorsuch, which is not what I was expecting going into the oral argument. But I, you know, his questions suggest that he's very skeptical of the government's position, that he's nervous about the implications of the government's position. And George, you know, the small business plaintiffs in these cases who are basically being taxed into oblivion are exactly the kinds of plaintiffs to whom Justice Gorsuch has historically been sympathetic when it comes to, you know, small business versus big government. That doesn't mean it's going to be 5-4. It just means that, like, when I'm thinking of sort of my, you know, probability index, you know, I think that's the most likely sort of fifth vote. But I think it's revealing, George, that if you look at almost every major media outlet's coverage of the arguments, everyone used sort of a softly negative adjective to refer to how it went for the administration. Not that it's clearly going to go against them, but that it didn't go well. And I think that's right, which is, you know, the best argument, the most sort of the loudest argument we've heard from President Trump and the Justice Department about the tariffs is that there would be these massively deleterious consequences if the court were to strike them down. That didn't come up at all on Wednesday. And that, to me, is the dog that didn't bark when it comes to why I agree with the sort of, you know, soft.
But what was their argument there about the deleterious effect?
I mean, so, you know, you had these remarkable 28J letter, the supplemental letter that the Solicitor General filed in the Federal Circuit, and then in their briefs, basically that, like, without the tariffs, the economy will be destroyed, that these trade deficits are ruining the American economy. You know, George, I'm not an economist.
Did Sauer not go hard on that in the argument, or they just did
it
just,
is open
the court wasn't biting it?
No, so you know, the justices, as you know, George, the advocates get 2 minutes at the start. Well, 2 minutes unless they're divided into 1 minute. And so in his 2 minutes, he did mention it, but it never came up again. And I think that is, you know, a striking illustration that that's not where the justices were. And I think that to me is the biggest bad sign for the administration, that, like, what has been their strongest defense of the imperative of these tariffs just wasn't something that was even invoked by the justices in questioning the other side.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Right. And that probably that's because we've had a trade deficit in this country for a very long time, and it's nothing new, I would
assume. Also because, you know, if you really are a committed textualist, how does that change the meaning of words that Congress picked in 1977?
When we had a trade deficit.
That's right. And if you're Justice Gorsuch, right, that harm would still have to be balanced against the harm to these small businesses that are, you know, some of which are literally being taxed into destruction.
Absolutely.
And others of which are being taxed, you know, to a degree that's increasingly difficult for them to handle.
Another thing I thought was interesting, again, I didn't read the transcript, but I saw there was some discussion here and there about who bears, I mean, it's not legally relevant, but who pays for tariffs. And I didn't get the impression that the Solicitor General was taking the position that China pays the tariffs. All these countries pay the tariffs. How'd that go? And why did the court find, was the court interested in that in any way? It seemed like there were some questions that got there.
Yeah, I mean, it came up a couple times. So, I mean, part of the trickiness here, George, and you know this, is that the government is trying, is in some respects talking out of both sides of its mouth when it comes to who's paying the price for the tariffs. You know, legally, it would be to the Justice Department's rhetorical and analytical advantage for the answer to be China or the other countries. Right? Practically, of course, we all know better. Practically, the prices are being bared by these small businesses and by the consumers who now have to pay more for their goods. The reason why that matters is because if we get past the major questions doctrine, if we're doing what we might call sort of ordinary or old school statutory interpretation, you know, one of the real fights is about the meaning of the verb regulate in IEEPA and whether by giving the president the power to regulate under IEEPA, the power to impose tariffs could be inferred from that. And the challenger's argument, which I think is actually elegantly straightforward, is that there is a very big difference between regulating and raising revenue, and that regulating historically has not been understood to encompass taxing or other, you know, mechanisms of raising revenue. And so therefore, whatever else regulate in IEEPA might authorize doesn't authorize tariffs because tariffs are raising revenue. That came up a lot during the arguments. You know, there was a long exchange, for example, between Justice Barrett and Neil Katyal, who was arguing on behalf of the private plaintiffs about the difference between licensing and licensing fees, where, you know, I think Katyal's argument, which I thought was rather persuasive, was that licenses are fine under IEEPA, but not licensing fees, because one is a regulation and one is a tax. And that when you cross that regulatory to tax line, when you cross from the underlying rule to the penalty, right, that's the point at which Congress has to be more specific, or at least that's the point at which those verbs can no longer bear the weight that the administration is placing on them. Again, George, we never get there.
Let me play the devil's advocate here. And I don't know whether this dovetails with anything that Sauer might have argued, but can't you tax and regulate at the same time? I kind of remember there was this statute involving taxing and regulation. Had something to do with healthcare, and there was something called ACA. I don't remember what that was. Okay. I mean, and can't you, like, I mean, let's say you have an environmental regulation and, yep, and somebody's polluting. I mean, one of the ways to regulate pollution is to charge people for, yep, it, because they're using public resources by spewing things out in the atmosphere and, you know, externalities, what we learn in economics in college, that there are externalities being imposed by some people on the other. And the taxes can be used as a way of regulating those externalities. So why can't regulation be exercised in the form of a tax? We realize that some, let's say, want to impose sanctions on the country of blah, 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 and they make widgets. And we understand that some people in the United States want these widgets really badly and need these widgets really badly. And so there's a cost to us imposing these sanctions on the widget making country. And so the way we balance that regulatory, yin and yang is to say, well, we're going to impose a tariff up to this amount so that people can still get the widgets if they pay a certain amount of money. But most people won't, and we will be punishing the widget-making country who is evil and oppressing its people or whatnot. So why doesn't that mean that the government wins?
So I think we're conflating two things, right? One is, can the government use taxes to regulate? And the answer there is, of course, that's what taxes are. The other is, can the verb regulate in IEEPA be reasonably understood to reflect Congress's decision in 1977 to allow the president to use this particular statute for revenue raising measures? And it's the latter argument that I think is an attractive, plausible way to sort of say no. More than that, I mean, George, the other piece of the atmospherics here, which did come up again and again in the arguments, is that it's not like IEEPA is the only statute plausibly dealing with tariffs. There are many, many other statutes in which Congress has expressly and unambiguously given the president the power to lay and impose tariffs. President Trump relied upon some of those statutes successfully during the first Trump administration. So, you know, it's not the point about whether you can use revenue raising measures to regulate, I think, is absolutely, I mean, sure, you can. The question is that a reasonable reading of what Congress was meaning in IEEPA? And if you get past the major questions doctrine, in which case this would never come up, but if you get past the major questions doctrine, that's where I think the fight's going to be. And that's a big part of why I think you saw so much focus on that in the oral argument on Wednesday.
So anyway, one last question, I'll let you go. I know you're busy out in Los Angeles where you haven't had your Subway sandwich delivered yet. And I would literally throw a sandwich at you if someone asked me this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, since you are unarmed. If you were a Vegas odds maker, what odds would you place on this case?
I would say that I think the odds are somewhere in the ballpark of probably 65 to 75% that the court's going to block the tariffs. You can convert those odds into the odds makers metric. Is that like 3-1 or 1-3? I don't know. I don't bet. So I'm about, I'm
that, really, we're lawyers. We don't do math. Right. We're lawyers. Right.
But let me say, I mean, I think, George, I went into the argument really completely unsure. And the best thing I would have said going into the argument is that I was 50-50. The argument tilted. And it tilted against the tariffs in ways that I think were meaningful enough that that's why you're seeing so much of the public commentary take that view. There are two reasons why I'm not more confident. Reason number one, Justice Barrett, because, you know, although I think you can get to 5 without her, again, I think it could be a Gorsuch-Roberts 3 Dems majority. You know, I think her views are going to carry some force on the court. And she's just, George, so enigmatic when it comes to these high profile oral arguments. We have, you know, 5 or 6 examples now of Barrett clearly looking like she was going in one direction of the argument and then voting the other way. So that's complication number one. Complication number two is, you know, it's the first of the Trump cases that the court has on the merits. And, you know, there are, gosh, as of yesterday, 24 rulings on emergency applications, where I would have thought in at least some of them, some of these same justices would have gone the other way, and they didn't. And so, you know, we don't have data yet on whether sort of ordinary predictive powers are going to map onto the Trump cases on the merits, because this is the first one. So, you know, I would be more confident in the ballpark of 80% if we didn't have both of those variables. But I still think it's more likely than not the tariffs are going down. And, you know, George, I think probably, you know, not overnight. I think this will take some time, and that we're probably looking at a decision in January or February where, you know, my best guess is that the court will leave, if they do strike down the tariffs, it will leave the messier question of what happens next and what remedies, if any.
Whether people get their money back and such. Yep.
I think they'll kick all that back down to the Court of International Trade.
Okay. I mean, that's great. And thank you so much. I would note that there were some prediction market graphs that I saw on social media that basically showed that the percentage in favor of the plaintiffs went up at some point during the argument. I'd love one of these days to be able to match up, time sync the arguments with the questions and answers with that. But we'll see. And we're really looking forward to seeing. We'll have you back when it comes down.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having me, George.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No